Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Vern from Long Beach. Seal Beach. Welcome. You're on.
Hi, I'm Vern Alcoholic.
And,
I got lost coming here, so I want to thank Carla for asking me to come, and thank my friends Russell and Alicia for coming out here. Like, she got me on the phone and then put me on the phone to Terry, and Terry guided me here. I could not find this street. I mean, I'd hate to be liquored up in this town. I mean, like I would really be screwed. You know? But I like going out of town and talking. You know, I just like doing it, you know. To me, there's a difference, between going out of town and getting out of town. Anybody here ever had to get out of town? One? Got one anyway, you know. I did one time real fast, you know, like, I was gone for 6 years, so that's how scared I was, you know, I mean, like, I ripped off these drug dealers, they told somebody even if I gave the money back, they were going to kill me anyway, so that's all I needed to hear, you know, I just got out of Dodge when I heard that, you know, my drinking took me a lot of different places, I'm from Windsor, Ontario, Canada, and I lived in Detroit when I was a little kid, and we moved to California. My dad wanted to start us a new life there, but I loved it downtown Detroit. We lived on Jefferson Avenue, above a liquor store and a confectionery store and a bar. You know, and my dad was a drunk, and he'd be in there doing a lot of drinking, and he'd get violent, you know, and I was afraid of him, you know, and I grew to hate him later on. But my mom was a French Canadian farm girl, you know, like ever loving and forgiving, and just like, you know, so. Just the best woman I ever, you know, just my best friend, you know, till the day she died. And so I was only dealt a half bad hand, you know, like I can't really blame, you know, how I turned out on anybody, you know. I mean, I did for a long time, but I blame my dad, and I just grew up scared, you know. I remember I just feared, like, dogged my every step, you know. I mean, about every move I made, it was usually fear based, and I grew up being afraid of anything that had a slight quiver to it. You know, I mean, I was really, you know, unless I had something in me to change the way I felt, you know, like and I'd take anything, you know, it didn't matter. I mean, if somebody give me some pills, I'd just swallow them. Go, by the way, what was that? You know, it didn't matter. Anything to get me away from right here, I'd take it, you know. I just did that for years. We ended up in Pico Rivera, and mostly a Latino school I went to, and I hung around with these two kids that they had about 15 kids in their family, and I hung around two of the younger ones, and they made moccasins, the whole family did, every day, and they sold them on the weekends. And the dad there was, like, so they'd get home from school, they'd make moccasins, and then they'd do their homework, and then if they weren't too tired, they could go out and play. You know, I mean, this guy held his whole family together selling moccasins door to door. But he was a great big guy, and just a real gentle, kind guy, and he didn't drink. And his kids loved him to be around him. They were always hugging and kissing him. And he'd come up when we were playing baseball or something, get out of his truck, and come over And the kids would just go, you know, I mean, they weren't embarrassed to be, you know, like it was, he was really a good man. And I wanted to stay at their house, you know. So back then, and I was young, and I could tell the difference. I didn't like being around my house. I liked being at their house. I wanted to stay with them. I wanted to be adopted by them, don't come to think of it, you know. And we moved to Anaheim after that, and my mom took us to this church down the street from where the Crystal Cathedral is now, and it was all orange groves out there back then, you know, the orange groves everywhere back then, a long time ago, and we were going to Sunday school in these army tents in the middle of this orange grove. It was freezing cold there in the winter, you know. I mean, it's like, and they were in this. The church was doing odd jobs and rummage sales and fundraisers to put money together to build a Sunday school. And I really laughed. It was the first time I'd ever been part of anything. I was just having a blast. And this minister was this great big movie star looking dude. You know, he had the do hairdo and the bangled vest and the Colgate smile on him, you know, and he's smooth talking guy. I mean, he looked like Tyrone Power or something, you know. And I'd get in line over and over again to shake his hand, you know. When you say goodbye to the minister, well, I'd get back in line again, do it again and again, you know. Anyway, about a year went by, and they raised about $100,000, you know. And back then, that was a lot of money, you know, quite a bit of dough. And that minister skipped town with the money. And he left his pregnant wife, too. And he went to Costa Rica or somewhere, and they never caught him, and he really did it, you know. Like, and that was before Jimmy Swaggart or any of them guys were getting caught at anything, you know what I mean? I mean, just nothing was going on like that that anybody spoke of, you know. I mean, it just didn't happen. And, you kind of equate church with God, you know, and that kind of put a kink in my head there, you know, like a little bit. And and I joined the Cub Scouts, and I got burned again. You know, I mean, I won this big award. I was really liking being a Cub Scout, and I won this award. They voted it down to two Cub Scouts, and it was just me and this other kid out of 300 Scouts. You know, a big pack meeting they had every month, and I won it, but they gave it to the other kid because he was a crybaby, you know. And that was my first real resentment, man. I remember I just wadded up all my clothes and went to the den mother and threw it in the door. I said, I don't have nothing to do with you guys anymore. You know, I'm all done with you, period, you know. And I met up with these kids that were breaking into things, you know, and stealing. And I just joined up with them, you know. I mean, and I was about 9 years old at the time. And one night my dad came home in a blackout with another woman. And my mom never complained about anything, you know. But he came there, had her in the car in the driveway. And my mom said, well, that's the last straw. And, you know, like a couple weeks went by. And we're going, where's Dad? We haven't seen him for a couple of weeks. You know, he's been missing. What's going on? She pulled us in that living room and said, Dad's not going to be living here anymore. We're getting a divorce, you know. And my brothers were crying. And my mom was crying, telling us the story, you know. And I wasn't crying, you know. My brother, I grabbed him out. I said, what are you crying for? This prick is gone. We can do whatever we want to do. That's what I thought, you know. I mean, you know, we are free at last, brother. Stop crying. You know, he just got in my way, you know. I mean, period. That's what I looked at, you know. And I got arrested for burglary at age 12. I started sniffing glue and huffing gas at age 11. And a Carbona rug cleaner. I didn't do that very long. That really stayed with me a little too long. I stopped doing that one. It gave me a lot of headaches, too. I mean, but I stopped doing that. But we moved to a house where I got my own bedroom, finally. You know what I mean? I got my own room. There was a trap door in the closet that went underneath the house, you know? And nobody knew about it except me. And I made a little fort underneath the house. I put a piece of carpet in there and dug out pockets in the dirt and put little candles. And my transistor radio there and my dirty magazines. And, you know, and I'm 11 years old doing this, and I that was where I first learned how to make love to myself. And I'm in there huffing gas, sniffing glue, and I thought, I ain't never coming out of here. I'll tell you what, that was my reality, and I had my little plastic army men in there. I mean, it was like, you know. And then later on, my brother found it. You know, he found it, and he ratted me off, so they nailed it shut or screwed it shut, messed up, so, you know, put a wrench in my world, you know. You know, I started taking Bennies and Reds, and then the first thing, I drank wine, Valley High wine. We stole it out of the Thrifty Mart and drank it in my friend's cornfield. He was growing corn for school. And we all three of us got real drunk on it. I know I stole it because I had a picture of a hula lady on the bottle. I thought it was kind of cool, you know. So I took that, you know, and just got hammered. My first time drunk. And I got home drunk, and my mom called my dad and snitched me off. And the next morning, I wake up with him beating the living daylights out of me, and I threw up purple all over the bed. I was sick, hungover, and he's beating me. You know, and I thought, I'll never do that shit again. You know, I mean, I'm all done with that. You know, I mean, I'll never do that again. And next Friday night, I'm boosting more wine out of the Thrifty Mart, you know. Like it says in the big book, you forget a day or a week or a month ago, all the pain and suffering you endure, and you do it again, expecting different results or whatever it says. That's when I was alcoholic, man. You know, like when I went like that, I was alcoholic. I was not born that way, you know. Because I started out as a pretty good kid, you know. I mean, you know, I had a paper route, I mowed lawns, you know. I mean, just things just started getting bad when I turned around 9, you know. Like that was like when my mom kicked my dad out, I just did whatever I wanted to do, you know. I mean, I got in a lot of trouble. I went to juvenile hall 5 times, you know, petty thefts, and I was always in trouble on probation. I mean, it was just like, you know, I put my mom through hell. And I turned 17 and just left home, you know. I took off, and I never called, wrote, or nothing, you know. And ended up in the mountains in Oregon, you know, with lived in a cabin. I had one neighbor in 25 miles, 2 dogs, 2 goats, and a cat. And the cops were after me, you know. I had warrants all over the place. I mean, I was in a lot of trouble. So I just got, you know, left, and I met these hippies in Laguna Beach, made me a fake ID. And they were making phony passports for people that wanted to leave the country to get out of the draft, but they made me a complete set ID because they liked me. And anyway, I'm up in the mountains, and I was like a hippie, you know. I was a real hippie, you know. I mean, and I wasn't a fake one, I was a real one, you know. And I was proud of it, too. You know, like, I had to chop my own wood. I mean, it was like a daily chore just to get wood, make enough wood to last the winter, you know. And, the nanny goat, I'd get a quart of milk from her in the morning and a quart at night, you know, and I wasn't eating any meat, and I was a vegetarian, and I wasn't doing any drugs, and I wasn't drinking, and, you know, I was like really healthy, you know. I mean, I was really getting, I was only 19 years old by then. That's how long I was there. I turned 20 up there sometime, but I didn't see one human face for 2-3 months at a time, you know. I mean, I was a hermit, and the dogs would start barking, and somebody come up there, I'd get depressed because I knew I'd had to talk to somebody, you know. And that's not normal, you know. I mean, it's like, and I turned 20 up there, I didn't know what month it was, you know. I mean, this is how, like, I'd tie that goat up in the kitchen and milk her. And sometimes I'd just get in a hurry, I'd hold my cereal bowl right under and milk her right into the bowl. You know? I mean, I told my sponsor that story, and he goes, oh, that sounds a little too woodsy for me. You know? Yeah? But really, if you ever lived on a farm, it's no big deal. No big deal. Anyway, The snow fell too heavy there, and I had to move out of that cabin because it was like 9 feet. I mean, it was just like I would have died if I had stayed there. So I moved down to the valley and got a job on a chicken ranch where all these hippies were living, you know, in A-frame cabins and stuff like that. And I got a job on this chicken ranch, and I plowed and irrigated squash fields and fed chickens. It was the worst job I ever had in my life. I'll never work on a farm. I mean, it was just like horrible. I mean, this guy had 10,000 chickens, and it took me all day to feed them twice, you know. I mean, and then he had me plowing, irrigating squash fields, and I mean, there was nothing but squash fields for miles. He dropped me off and leave me there. And this one guy, a hippie friend of mine, he brought me some dandelion wine and some of this weed that, it's so good, you just take one hit and you're just like in the promised land, you know what I mean? Like, and I'm drinking the dandelion wine and it tastes so bad. I mean, this stuff tastes bad. And I drank it anyway, and I couldn't keep that tractor up on the furrows. Like, so I ended up mowing down most of his squash plants with a blade on, and I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell. I didn't have the heart to tell him, you know, and I'm not, you know. So I just left that job like every other job. I just ran, you know. I mean, I couldn't face any responsibilities, you know. I mean, it was just like I was worthless. I'll tell you right now, you know. And I've been through so many jobs. A friend of mine just got fired from the job a little while ago. And I said, well, you know, it's all right. It's better to be fired. That way you don't look like a quitter, you know. It made him feel a little bit. And you get your check right away, you know. Like, he goes, yeah, you know. That's I came back to town, and that's when I met up with this guy, and we were sticking up drug dealers. And so I took off. I ended up in Texas, and then Chicago, and back into Detroit, and back into Canada, back into Detroit again. And lived on the waterfront there near Cass Corridor. It's a real rough area. It's real bad. It's a nice place to be away from. Let's put it that way, you know. And one time I got beat up real bad by these biker dudes. They were after this Indian I was with, and I didn't do a damn thing, and I got a worse beating than him. They put me in the hospital. You know, they're after this big Indian. And my grandmother saw me and bought me a one-way ticket back to California. So my grandmother saved my life. You're going to get right down to it. If I'd have stayed in that area, I probably wouldn't have a different speaker tonight. You know? And came back here, you know? Ended up at Mom's place, you know? And I'm in her little trailer, liquored up every day, you know? And somebody in AA got to her and said, throw that bum out. You know? He's going to die in your house. You're killing him by letting him stay there. You know, you're loving him to death. That's what they told her. And so she wrote me a check and paid me to leave. You know, I remember saying to her, how could you do this after all I've done for you? You know, telling my mother that, you know, I mean, damn. Anyway, before that, though, before I came back, I was running a car wash when I was in Windsor, and met this girl, nice Canadian, French-Canadian farm girl, just like Mom. You know, real nice girl. I mean, real pretty, and had nothing but the best coming. And what she ever saw in me, I'll never know, you know. I mean, to this day, I can't figure out what she saw in me, you know. And we got a place together. We were going to get married, and she didn't like my drinking and carrying on and partying and leaving, coming back, and didn't like my gangster friends I made there. And I'd leave for days at a time, just like my dad used to do, you know. And one day I came home, and there was my feet, my clothes were packed on the porch in 3 feet of snow. Yeah. I said, wait, I come home, and I go, what are you doing? You got to get a grip on yourself here, you know. You know, after all I've done for you, you know. That's the kind of attitude I had. I mean, I was a real jerk, you know. I mean, I look back on that, you know. And she did exactly what she should have done, you know. And I left, and I rented a room along the Detroit River, and it was in a shanty house, what they call a shanty house. You rent a room for $20 a week, and you share a bathroom at the end of the hall with a bunch of weirdos, you know. And you could hear rats nesting in the walls, those wharf rats from the riverfront. I mean, this place, here I'm, back then I was in my mid-20s, and I'm on Skid Row, you know. 25, 26 years old, I'm on Skid Row. It's like not a good combo, you know? Like, I mean, I was like really screwed up. And the cops were looking for me there, and some more people I ripped off were looking for me. My girlfriend was gone, and I had this job in this car wash, and this guy was bringing me weed to sell. And somebody told him, and I sold it for him. I had his money right away. And he came back again, and it brought jewelry and fur coats, you know, TVs and stereos and guns and, you know, black market seafood from Nova Scotia. You know, I mean, it was like he was bringing me stuff. And what I didn't know is this guy was a dink gangster. You know, I mean, I didn't know, as stupid as I was. You know, and I mean, and he was like using me because the cops were watching him, and they'd deliver that stuff, and I'd sell it, and I'd make more money off of him than I was at the car wash. And he wore black leather pants, and he had this greasy hair. He was a little tiny French-Canadian bisexual lunatic. You know, and he wore those black gloves with the holes in the knuckles, the leather. I mean, this guy, I was terrified of him. You know, he was like, I figured out just who he was. You know, and this is how scared I was of this guy. One day, the car wash was really busy, and I had all this money wadded up in a paper bag, and I just threw it in his car. You know, and he complained about it. From then on, I ironed his money for him. You know, tens, twenties, hundreds, everything straight up, stacked this night, you know. I mean, I was like, I went out of my way to impress people that I was afraid of and didn't even like, you know. I mean, I was just a real white trash when you get right down to it, you know. I look back on that, it's like embarrassing, you know. Thank God for the serenity prayer and the steps, you know, like, and I lost that job, and I'm in that little room there, and thinking, what's the point of even living anymore? You know, I remember I didn't want to live, you know. But I don't remember doing this. I'm taking barbiturates like crazy and drinking. And I'd hung myself from the stairway outside the door. And this old man downstairs found me hanging there and cut me down. And they stuck me in, and they put me in the paramedics came, and I was dead on arrival at the hospital. And they stuck me in the hospital, and I came to in the hospital, and I was breathing out a tube up my neck. They had to do a tracheotomy because I crushed my throat. And there was a man and woman standing there, and the woman was crying. And I asked the nurse, I started coming around, I go, who's that? She goes, those are your parents. I didn't even know who they were, you know? I mean, I didn't know my name, what year it was, how I got there, what happened, nothing. My memory was completely gone. I had lost blood or oxygen or something to my brain. I don't know what, but I had no memory. And they stuck me in a mental institution, you know? And, you know, I got in there, and you could see through that hole in my neck. You could see inside my throat. I light a cigarette, I could blow smoke out my neck. And every time I'd light a cigarette, them nuts would get around me and just go, and then the hole, it healed up. I couldn't do it anymore, and then they just ignored me after that. And I remember how my feelings were hurt because I felt like I was a role model in a nut house because I could blow smoke out my neck. You know, I mean, I was like, you know, so far I needed to be there, I guess. You know, but I the whole time I was there a long time. I give it a little before or later than a year, and I made one candle holder the whole time I was there, and that's how screwed up I was, you know. And they let me out of there. Finally, let me out of there, and a guy took me to my first AA meeting, you know. And I just left at the coffee break, you know. I mean, I just didn't want to go. You know, I mean, I just like thought all the people were in there were nuts. You know, I just got let out of a nut house because they were nice and happy, you know, and I was miserable. And so I ended up, when my grandmother saw me after those guys worked me over and went back to California, ended up my mom's, and I ended up on the street. And I was living in a 73 Chevy behind Dick's Horseshoe Saloon in Costa Mesa. Anybody ever did any drinking there? It was the oldest bar in Orange County. And they poured the strongest drinks around, you know. And I love that bar, you know what I mean? I mean, I really like it. Anytime, if you go to, well, if your feet stick to the floor and the bathroom smells really rank, that's a good bar to me, you know. I mean, I loved it there. And it was just all kinds of people. Baseball players that come in there, cowboys from the rodeo, from the fairgrounds, talent scouts from Angel Stadium, teachers, hookers, bikers, you know, bums. I mean, there was just all kinds of people in there. I mean, I'd never seen a bar like that since, you know. I mean, it was like, man, I just love this place. And they kicked me out of there, you know, for being too drunk. But I remember, God, I was just thought my world was over when they kicked me out of that bar. But they let me back in. You know, I mean, they always want your money, unless you do something really stupid. But anyway, that's when I started going to, somebody poured me into Charlie Street Detox, you know. And this was in the 80s by then. And, I remember my dad had took me to a couple of meetings when I was a little kid. And I remember seeing, you know, hearing them read steps and stuff, but it was all Chinese to me, you know. But I started going to AA meetings, and my dad was sober, you know, and he encouraged me, and we sat in some AA meetings together, and all that hatred disappeared, you know. He never made any direct amends, but just sitting in AA meetings with him, being around him, and that all being gone was good enough for me, you know. And I ended up in a recovery home, and that's where I learned about the 12 steps, because I couldn't see, I couldn't hear things in AA meetings. You know, I mean, I just couldn't. Things had to be drilled into me. I had to be drop-kicked emotionally. And the guy that owned the recovery home, he just passed away last week. He was 44 years sober. His name was Bob Husted. And, I'm forever grateful for that guy. He's the first guy to get my attention, you know. Like, I can't see that clock there. What time do I stop? 5 minutes? Okay. Yeah. But he's the guy that got my attention, I'll tell you right now. And he said things that hurt my feelings, you know, like, and that was the only way to get me to listen. And, you know, like, I've been sober 5.5 years now. I was sober 13 years, and I got hooked on pain medication. And I've been back 5.5 years now. And I feel like I never left, you know. I feel pretty good. I just joined H&I again, and you know, I got the meetings I go to real regular. But my dad ended up killing himself. He committed suicide here a number of years ago. And that was the worst thing I'd ever seen. You know, and I've seen some stuff that a gag a maggot, you know. And I saw him laying there after what he did to himself. And all the people came to his funeral, all in AA. People who didn't even know him came and showed up for me, you know. I started seeing what this fellowship is all about. And then 2 years ago, Mother's Day, my mom got really sick. And so I thought, the next day, I talked to her on the phone, the next day my truck got stolen, my work truck, with all my equipment on it. So I thought, well, I'll just go over and stay with my mom as I'm not working until I get things back together again. So I went over there, and she fell out of bed in the middle of the night, and I put her in the hospital, and the next day she died. And that was my best friend. You know, I mean, it was like, you know, and I was so depressed and so feeling sorry. I'm as in crybaby heaven, you know. I mean, I was so, you know, I mean, I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't want to talk to anybody. A, it was not working for me. I wasn't swinging with none of this, and I just stayed home. And this girl I was dating asked me to come. She was a special needs teacher, asked me to come to the high school prom. And so I didn't want to go. Friday night came, she goes, "Let's, you want to go? Come on." Kept bird dogging me to go. So finally I go, okay, what the hell? I'm not doing nothing. Anybody watching TV? And so I went to the thing, and she gave me a camera to take pictures of the kids. And so I'm right up on the stage, right a part of everything. And These Down syndrome kids have relationships, or boyfriend and girlfriend. I didn't know that, you know. And this Latino girl had her come up, totally blind, and come out and sang a Beatles song. You know, she sang "Hey Jude." I mean, tell you, it was just like watching American Idol. I mean, she was that good, totally blind, about 12 years old. And they made this one guy king and queen of the prom. And the guy was a real tall, mentally challenged kid, and they put a crown on his head. And he just let out a blood-curdling scream and took off running, you know. And they're all pinching at him and laughing at him and making fun of him. And he never came back. I don't even know what happened to him, you know. But I'll tell you what, when I left that dance that night, I felt like tap dancing. All that self-pity, all that poor baby me, all everything was gone, and I've been okay ever since. And I played Santa Claus for him last Christmas. So, I mean, they got me every Christmas. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't really mean you have to help another alcoholic. You just help another person, you know. And, you know, I'll tell you what, I feel like this is the best show in town. If I wasn't sober, I wouldn't be doing nothing like that. And, you know, and I find a higher power here. And I got some friends that I could be like Rip Van Winkle, go into a coma. And all my shit would still be there when I come out of it. You know, I mean, they wouldn't sell it at the pawn shop. You know, like, you know, friends like that are hard to find. And, I mean, if there's anybody new in here, I'm awful sorry I was late, but you can stay sober. By hook or by crook, show yourself some staying power. You know, that you can do this and have a good life. And that's all. Thanks.